You're listening to Red Nation Online.
Sunday, July 15th. It's Andre Zadorozny and I'm Ian Clark, and we are a day after Toronto FC's first ever victory at Gillette Stadium as they downed the New England Revolution 1-0. An early winner from Luis Silva was enough, as the much maligned defense were able to lock it down with the help of two outstanding saves from Milos Kosic. However, the cloud over this win is the loss of Danny Kovermans, as we discuss what his injury could mean, but we also look back on the last 3 years of Julian de Guzman post Friday morning's trade, all in the next 40 minutes on Eastside Stand Up.
From your house, I'm back from mine. Once again, we're at Stanley Park Studios.
Yeah,
it seems to be the place to be this summer.
South End,
it's pretty nice.
North End.
The trees act as a natural like sound buffer, except for when a motorcycle rides by. But overall, it's a pretty good spot.
We'll make it work.
We're outdoors, we're drinking coffee.
Isn't that nice?
And Toronto FC wins.
Unbelievable.
It's almost the perfect Sunday. If it was sunny, then it'd be the perfect Sunday, but
we've
you know what? I'll take a cloudy Sunday with a TFC win
totally
over a sunny Sunday.
There's
and a
no
TFC
rain.
Loss.
Toronto is now has lost one game in seven. How's that for a stat? Too late. Too little. Too late.
1-7. That's an interesting stat because couldn't you just say they've lost 2-8?
I could.
Why not? Why not?
You see the spin doctoring.
Why not just conveniently slice out that first game against Kansas City to make it look a little bit better? Well, I saw an interesting stat last night too, where they said something like they're unbeaten when scoring first, which is two wins and two ties, which means there's something like 20 other games that don't factor into that,
amazing,
that statistic.
Yeah.
So it's like...
Did you love statistics? Numerically, they just cut out the fat and give you what you want.
That's the beauty of statistics. You know, if you want something, you can find it in a stat.
That's right.
To prove your point.
Prove your point and somehow doom the other team or something.
Yeah, it's the numbers. Hey, the numbers don't lie.
That is right. The numbers don't lie unless you make them lie.
And circling back to the numbers don't lie, Toronto FC wins 1-0 on the road against New England. I don't know how this season's going to finish off. Mm-hmm. You know, we'll get to Kovermans being out and we lost to Guzman and how this team's going to rebuild. But in the moment of, you know, beating Vancouver 3-2 at home in the manner that we did, and then yesterday going into New England, we've never won there. And I think the best we've done is a draw, and they'll draw in a 1-1 draw, but there's been times where they've hammered us. And we go in there and get the win, which was, I'd be honest, I'm pretty shocked considering the schedule we've been going through, two games a week, and looking at New England, who's been playing one game a week.
Yeah,
that's what their schedule's been like for the last month. And the foreseeable future, I think, for the next 2 weeks. And if you look at them on paper again, they look like a team that's got a few more pieces.
Yeah. But as New England's trajectory kind of been solid, they've been working slowly, whereas Toronto's been kind of swinging back and forth and coming off a huge win from your friend there, Dunfield.
Yeah,
a massive win for that team for Toronto in general and the fans, and then coming off from that and actually solidifying, looking like a team that is solid in many aspects. I mean, we'll talk about, again, Kovermans and what that means from that solid base that Mariners trying to build. But I'm not surprised that they won that game. Not at all.
Really?
And switching, maybe this is a change of culture in the team, and they want to play for this coach. So maybe, hopefully, the days are gone where we're like scratching our heads during an away game. And if they win more away games, then I think the end of the season is more away games than home games, correct? So this is a good thing.
Yeah, because I think that's where I'm coming from is with this team, is that, you know, a lot of my opinions and a lot of my, you know, predictions, whatever, I'm extrapolating from previous performances. They're based on precedents. And I couldn't help but look at, you know, when you're going into New England, the history of playing against this team, and then what we recently saw in Philadelphia. You know, Philadelphia is a team that's worse than New England, and we just got completely obliterated.
We're going back to stats.
Yeah, right? Yeah. There, hey, yeah, there you go. I'm pulling from the stats, and everything pointed to me that I saw from that pointed to a 2-1 win for New England. And you know, coming out to this game, let's start rolling into it. When we talk about the lineup, I mean, that's another issue that's going on with this team right now. Is the bot is like it's thin, and really the players that started this game were the best that were available, but probably not the best or the ones available you would want necessarily all the time. I mean, we still are dealing with Richard Eckersley as a center back.
Yeah.
And oddly enough, Donnell Henry starts at right back with Jeremy Hall out. I think he's also a ligament damage, or he pulled a hamstring or something like that from last game.
And Matt Stinson made an appearance.
He made a late appearance, Matt Stinson. But I think also that just comes down to it. It's like,
yeah.
we're really down to the wire.
Yeah.
We're really down to the wire. And you know, and up top, we see Johnson and Kovermans, of course. And in the midfield, Lamb, Dunfield, Frings, and Silva. So Avila doesn't get the start, but Silva does. And I think that's probably based on merit, based on performance.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, it was a quick start to the game. I mean, we scored within the first 10 minutes.
Yeah.
We've seen this before where Toronto's been able to get off to a quick start.
Or either going down a quick start. There's something about that first 10 minutes that is something to watch for and against. Mainly against, as we've seen, but it's nice to go ahead. And those forwards and everybody going forward, that's pretty solid to me. I mean, that's nothing to be ashamed of. Obviously, the back line is something we're all worried about, and a bit of that midfield, but those guys, like Johnson and Kuperman's, that's solid. And I think it proved how that's coming together.
Yeah.
Scoring, what, 8 minutes into the game.
Yeah. And that was, I mean, that was the build-up to that play was excellent.
That was beautiful.
Where you saw Reggie Lamb, you know, he hasn't produced like he had. We've seen him earlier on the year. He's done some nice work 1v1. We saw that tonight, or we saw that last night. Some good work with the ball on his feet. And we saw him work in, and he dishes it off. We had just that nice sort of like pinball action right through the middle, and they worked it from Lamb to Silva to Kovermans, and Kovermans with the nice touch. I mean, that's what you want from that target man, not just to be this big lumbering guy.
Right, and that's exactly where he's molding. Unfortunately, the injury happened today, but that is where he was going, and everybody was kind of shitting on him about, I know a lot of, like, my brother, and I know that Steve Perry wasn't too happy with him, but as a target man, he's coming and scoring goals. A, he was scoring goals on that crazy red-hot streak. Now, he's not scoring so much, but now he's making those touches.
Yeah.
He's showing his class. He's getting fitter, and hopefully this works out for us.
Yeah, yeah. And that's it. And then he finishes off to Silva, who now gets his second goal in two games.
Yeah, slotted in. And his father just passed away, I believe.
Yeah, so that was all within the debacle in Houston.
Right.
So that was in that little stretch there. But it's nice to see, you know what I mean? Like, that's the thing that Toronto has always lacked, and Toronto needs is, you know, they need those secondary goal scorers. And even finding the primary goal scorer has been tough for this team. And, you know, we've only had it, you know, you can sort of say Danny Dicchio, but he would go on and off.
Well,
Tony DiRosario as well, and he didn't get much support. And then Danny Koverman, who I think is probably been the most balanced attack I think we've had.
Yeah, maybe that's what this team needs, is a balanced attack. Yeah. Rather than just focusing on a type A personality player like DiRosario was, who was selfish and only, you know, but he could, I mean, he obviously was a good player, but you need someone that can play off each other rather than just, give it to him.
Yeah, so we rolled through this first half. I mean, even the whole game was pretty quiet in itself, but of course in the first half, other than the goal, there is one other significant moment, and that was at the 40th minute when you see, in Kovermans, you know, you should say that too, I mean, in that first half, Kovermans did have some nice runs. He was doing everything you want your forward to do. And he gets this nice run. He's released, and he sort of like pulls the ball up, sort of just at the touchline there. And the defender kind of runs through him a bit, knocks the ball out of play. And you're sitting there watching it, and he's holding his. If I remember correctly, the defender knocks his right knee,
and then
but
he's
holding
his
left.
Yeah.
Knee. And
I didn't see. Like, I don't know what he. Like, it's very strange. It's hard to see. I saw the replay several times. I watched it online.
Maybe we'll hear more tonight. We were recording this on Sunday afternoon. You know, things will probably trickle out through the day, maybe even Monday morning when people are listening to this, they'll already know. But the first thing you're hearing coming out is that, you know, the New England medical staff or the initial preliminary reports are that it's not good. It's not good. And when someone's holding their knee like that, you know, you're thinking, ligament damage, you're thinking ACL, you're thinking tears or pulls or whatever. And if that's an ACL tear, he's toast.
Could be over.
He's toast. You know what I mean? That is, you know who I was trying to think of, you know, famous athletes who go through that. And I think the most recent one I can think of is George St. Pierre.
Right.
And he's, I think he's messed up both of them. He tore one, recovered, and he is like, you know, one of those guys where you can't compare Koverman's to George St. Pierre. George St. Pierre is a hyper athlete, you know, in terms of like physical athleticism.
But in terms of knees and cardio, I mean, you need your knees. These guys all do tons of cardio.
Right. I'm just saying, if you stand George St. Pierre against, you know who the better
but
athlete
the thing
you know
is,
who's more fit.
You're right. Okay? But an ACL is an ACL.
And my point is, though, is that, I mean, he required a long recovery period to come back from it. So what we're looking at, if that's the case, he's done for the season.
At least, minimally. If not, I mean, like you were saying earlier on the walk here, career ending, possibly.
Well, you look at his age. You know, it's you know, again, George St. Pierre comes back from that within 6 months, which
he's
is a
in
miracle.
His 20s.
But he's in his mid to late 20s at the peak of his physical, you know, abilities.
Right.
Whereas Danny Koverman's is a guy who's now in his, you know, early, pushing towards his mid 30s. Yeah. The recovery rate's a lot slower.
Yeah.
And then to come back at 34 and sort of have that touch again, it's going to be really
and
tough.
And a team that's consistently in flux. Mm-hmm. Like, who knows? Like, by the time he's fit, by the time he's ready, he could be shipped out or be out of here.
And that's an interesting question. You know, maybe we'll roll on to the end. Is like, what do you do in this situation? You know, what do you do? Are we going to, you know, because it's like the team, you can say, is in transition now that we've, you know, we've gone from Aaron
we can
Vinters
say that again and over again.
Well, you know, I could say rebuilding, but I feel like I've said it so many times that it's sort of lost its
what's the definition of an insanity?
It's lost its panache.
Right.
Rebuilding has lost its panache. We need to come up with something new. Transition, or what do we we had another joke a couple weeks ago where we came up with another word for rebuilding, retooling,
readjusting. Sure.
It's a readjustment is what we're going through right now. So that's an interesting thing because, you know, you can't help but look at the guys that came in, especially the DPs in terms of Koverman's and Frings. And I'm sure Paul Mariner likes Danny Koverman's because he's more of that prototypical English striker, I would say, more than a Dutch one. He's probably like almost like a perfect blend.
Right.
And that he's got the size, but he's also got
skill.
Got the touch on the ball. That's you know, it's a little bit unique. So my point was going to be that maybe Mariner, if he's trying to implement his own system, his own team, his own players, you know, these guys might not fit in, and he might not want DPs that are in their mid to late 30s or mid to early 30s or whatever. So that's an interesting thing I think that's going to happen is what are they going to do with Koverman's?
It kind of came at a perfect time, though, in a weird, strange way. I mean, we were talking about this on the way here, the De Guzman trade, and going to Dallas, and now Koverman is getting injured. Now, how does this benefit the team? I know it's a negative thing in terms of Koverman.
It's a negative in the short term.
In the short term, but in the long term of things, lots of names are being bandied about. Bocanegra.
Melberg.
McKenna. And
Del Piero still,
but if he doesn't go to New York or L.A., he's not going to come at all. I mean, that'd be fascinating if he came to Toronto. That'd be quite a coup.
I feel like it's Del Piero 5 years and counting. Like, I feel like every year since the DP rule came out, it's like Del Piero Toronto has always been one. It seems to get sillier and sillier that every year it's like his name reappears. As much, you know, he's surpassed Paul Dykov, but, you know, he's up there. He's up there with a guy that seems to show up every year. But let's roll into the second half. Not a lot of action, but I think it is just worth noting in terms of, like, you know, we're talking about the game, we're talking about the team, the changes. And I don't know about you, but, you know, when I see 1-0 scored in the 10 minutes, I am already saying, when will New England score?
Yeah.
At what point will they score? What, you know, and I'm
they
and
did
I'm,
score.
Yeah, right, with their hand.
Score.
Fair enough.
Hand of God.
Yeah. You know, but, when and sort of like how close to the final whistle will they score? That's the thing that I couldn't help but think as I'm watching the entire second half.
Couple set pieces near the end there. Little scary moments, but New England didn't have the class and they didn't have the skill to put it away. And I think that's more a luck than anything else.
Yeah.
And Toronto, you know, buried themselves in the back there, and it worked this time.
Yeah,
and maybe that back line until someone comes in that signed possibly a DP that can help out that back line.
Yeah.
Maybe they're learning from their mistakes.
Well, maybe they are. I still wouldn't. You know, I think one thing we saw this game that we didn't see in the last ones was that, you know, Torsten Frings didn't feature predominantly sort of in the attack, but he seemed to be doing a lot of work on the back. And without pulling like an Aaron Vinter and making him a fifth defender. My first instinct was that both him and Dunfield were given an assignment that they'd have to do, like work extra hard defending, you know, coming back and contributing that. And you saw them both getting stuck
in. But that's arguably their role as well, is when you switch to that, you know, take that two positions in the midfield and shoot them back, and to kind of keep going back and forth, which is takes a lot of fitness, but which both those guys arguably don't really have.
Right.
And there's a lot of huffing and puffing, and so, but they're doing a good job of it.
Yeah, that's it. You can't deny what they've been, you know, how they've been playing of late. You know, I think Frings has had a few games that have been touch and go, but he's had some games where he's played at the level that the standard he set for himself and the standard that we've seen from him. You know, especially that the game against Montreal and the game against Vancouver, against the two Canadian games. Mm-hmm. Hey, if you're going to save those performances for some teams, those are the ones. But I think, of course, we can't go through the second half without talking about Kosic.
Right.
Man
of the match.
The funny thing is that New England really wasn't able to create anything from open play.
Right.
Very few chances from open play, not too much dangerous, and Kosic didn't have too much work to do. It was pretty much exclusively on set pieces, mm-hmm. Corners and crosses. And at one point, I think I noted down around the 81st minute, I first noted it around the 50th minute, how, you know, Kosic, all he's dealing with is corners and set pieces. That's all that's all the work that he's working on this afternoon or on that night. By the 81st minute, New England been up 12-3 on corners, mm-hmm. and there was still plenty to come after that 81st minute. I would just think that by the end of the game, they would have had at least 15 corners.
And at least, and the rate of set pieces and special teams that TFC have been abysmal on, defending those set pieces, I'm surprised that New England didn't score two or three goals off that.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, and Kosic, when he had to come in.
He had two huge saves.
Huge saves.
The one where he just sort of like, that natural reaction to put his hand out. Mm-hmm. I think it was the last, it was the one I think that led to the handball goal.
Right. Makes a save.
He just had his hand out, and it just was like, again, just like that's his natural instinct as a keeper. Put his hand out there, blocked the shot. Incredible.
And rebounds and loose balls, kicking it out of play. He really, using his big frame, how tall he is. He's a very tall guy.
And, you know, it's this is the kind of game where it's like, you're happy for Kosic because of games like Real Salt Lake, where they lost that one in the dying seconds after, which was a pretty strong performance. Like, he's had games where he's played like that, and it's just like you can only tempt fate so many times before they finally break through, and for once it didn't happen. And it's funny because it's like we didn't quite frame it this way in the last podcast, but I kind of outlined it was like it's funny how in this game, you know, things kind of went our way for once. You know, we came back and then we took the lead, and Steve Perry wanted to sort of underline saying it seems like finally like luck is kind of on our side, that we're getting the luck, the bounces that everyone else was getting all this time. And that's two games in a row where it seems like that's happened. Where it's like, finally, we've been able to hold on.
Can't rely on that, though. Luck changes like the weather, right?
But, fine. We take when we get it. You know, and you can't. And hopefully you look at these kind of games and say, you know what? We were lucky that for whatever reason, New England just didn't have that verve to kind of cut through and slot a ball into to Sayre Sané or to
Joseph
Bengtsson or whatever.
Fairly quiet.
Yeah. Well, he was playing as a defender this time, right? Yeah. So he wasn't able to get too far. Or even Benny Failhaber, and they've got some talented guys on that team that just couldn't pull it off. So, you know, knock on wood. And we finished the game, and I think Andre and I were not hanging out last night. We watched the game separately. I asked him not to tell me the score. But he did send me one text that sort of, I thought, gave it away. But I'm happy that it didn't.
I misled you.
You did mislead me, and I'm glad that you misled me, because it was I missed, and that's the thing is I DVR'd the game, so it stopped right at the end. So the thing that preceded was I was even like 7 minutes. Like, what is this?
7 minutes of extra time.
Is this Man United?
It was
like,
unbelievable.
What's going? 7 minutes extra time, and I'm like, I couldn't even think what happened in the second half that was 7 minutes worth of.
Well,
Kovermans went down.
Yeah. We've all seen games. How much football and soccer have we seen, right? That 7 minutes is, if there's a huge stoppage of time, possibly violence, possibly something of that effect.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that 7 minutes off an injury, that's unheard of. I've never seen that.
Yeah.
5 minutes tops.
Yeah. So that was bizarre, and that's what led to Milos Kostas' Twitter apology after the game, because I don't know what he said.
No, I'll tell you what he said. He didn't say anything. He said fucking. He used the word fucking, but it was Larry Dobson, I think is his name.
Oh, it would have been Lee Godfrey.
Lee Godfrey is just giving him. It was very innocuous. It wasn't anything. An interview. It was very one of these, you know, cheesy interviews. Just quickly, how you feel? Oh, great game, whatever. And I think it's just his parlance, how he speaks. Sometimes we all, I like to swear.
It slips.
He slipped it out, and he covered it well. Covered it well. What I didn't like was the fact that was it TSN2 that was showing it, that they apologized. They apologized for it. It came back from the interview. They went back to the desk, and they apologized for it.
Interesting.
Okay. I mean, at 9:30 at night on a Saturday night. Come on.
Yeah.
Like, that's, you know, everybody hears the word once in a while.
It's funny because it's like, how many times have you watched any sport where they have like a mic on the ice or a mic on the court?
No, and that's what we're talking about.
And you hear people swearing.
And that game, before the whistle blew, I heard 4 swear words.
Yeah. Okay. So we wrapped this game up 1-0. First one ever at Gillette Stadium.
Six years.
Against, you know, again, like I said, I thought New England, I think New England is a pretty good team. And so I have, you know, you got to give a lot of credit to Toronto, especially through this streak that they've gone through of games. And again, the thing that I was pegging on this game was just New England should have been refreshed and ready to go, and Toronto should have been really, like, running on fumes.
Well, the issue with MLS, I'm being unfair here, but in terms of consistency gets bandied a lot. I believe in it. It's something that every team should aspire to. Consistency. Being consistent in what you do. Now, Toronto, New England, LA, a lot of these teams have been inconsistent. And some of the teams are benefiting from that and some aren't. So Toronto needs to find that consistency. And maybe they have it. Maybe they're having a rhythm here. And of course, football being so fluid, you can't. No team can be consistent all the time unless you're Man United, unless you're Man City, unless you're, you know, Real Madrid, someone who are on higher echelons. Mm-hmm. And but in terms of rate of play these days, I think Toronto's finding their rhythm, which is why that solid front end and trying to learn from the mistakes from the back end can help us and benefit us.
You know, the only thing that I kind of want to, you know, be on record for and sort of just sort of broach on this, on the team in our current run of form is, you know, I think, you know, I saw this when we went through the end of last year, and there was a lot made about that run we did at the end of the year. And there's quite a bit being made.
We're the Wigan of our time.
Yeah, about the run we're making. Well, that's the thing that I want to get at is, you know, we're doing really well now that the season is pretty much already done for us.
Is it, though? Is it mathematically 100% done for us? The way this...
You know, here's the statistic, Andre, is that, if I'm not mistaken, when we started, I think it was no team had made the playoffs ever starting 0-4. We went 0-9. I mean, to make the playoffs after that would be the most epic comeback.
It would
most,
be.
You know, that
wouldn't put it by us.
Imagine that in the same season that we would go from, in quotes, the worst team in the world to, you know, this, you know, Bad News Bears, you know, turnaround story. So, I mean, this is my point, is that when the team gets to that point, like even the last summer when Frings and Kovermans came in, you know, they didn't start moving, getting on all, you know, into fifth gear until like late August. Well, by that point, if you're not kind of in the contention, you're asking a lot. And chances are it's not going to happen. This year too, you know, starting off 0-9, and we're hovering around 2-10, and I think we're 3-10 or 3-11.
Still in last place.
Still a ways. You know, we still can catch other teams, but you're also banking on them going on horrible runs and them losing games.
Yeah.
I think it's just, you know, there's a mental hurdle that I think this team has never faced, whereas from March, they need to start playing like this. Not when they're sort of like they're 0-10, and for all intents and purposes, they're like, well, guys, that's the season. Like, you know, we're not going to make the playoffs now.
Yeah.
You can just go out there and enjoy yourselves.
But look how every season started itself. Mm-hmm. Every season started with a question mark. We haven't had a season, which is why I think I'm rooting for Mariner. I'm of the cloth where I root for every coach that we end up getting.
Sure.
I rooted for Preki, even though he was a jerk.
Yeah.
But you root for this coach who wants to at least have some type of solidity. We kind of had that with Winter coming into this season from last, but it fell all apart. And he would admit begrudgingly that he had left a lot wanting in that back line. He didn't make the proper trades. They lost a couple of players who didn't want to play here or through injury or whatnot. So I think it's the coach's, I think Mariner's job now is to, now, okay, let's say that the season's done. Okay, but now Mariner has to win games, regardless of if there's possibly a playoffs, right? And keep that consistency and keep that team together. And so when we start, you and I are talking this time next season, we're battling for first place or at least in the playoff run.
Right.
And that's his job. That's his job.
So now we can segue. Perfect segue, Andre, into next year. Changes, transitions, readjustments, however you want to say it. Of course, the big news that came out on, I guess it would have been Thursday night going into Friday, is of course...
I tweeted at 2 a.m. in the morning.
Yeah, I think I started hearing that around 11:30.
You texted me around midnight.
And then it really started, I think 2 a.m. was when...
Apparently the agent had texted someone.
So I think Molinaro came out saying he spoke to the agent and De Guzman is in fact traded. And that's what it is. So Julian De Guzman... traded, and I don't know. I think I'd rather almost talk about our thoughts on the, should we call it the Julian De Guzman era, Toronto the first DP era, something. I'm trying to come up with a clever way to sort of label, him coming to the team, because it was such an interesting. It was always something that was sort of hovering over the team, and a constant flux of positive and negative. And it was always a constant flux of, there's always, and it seems to be always the case with Toronto FC supporters, there's supporters who love him and supporters who hate him. Same thing with Di Rosario, same thing with Preki, or same thing with Aaron Vinter. Some people like them, some people hate him, even probably with Paul Mariner.
Di Rosario, people majority wanted him here. Mm-hmm. It was his actions as a person, as a professional, which everybody, if you like honesty and an honest person, you would have been ashamed of what he, how the kind of shit he was coming up with.
Right. Definitely the optics of, the way that it's just seeing it. Mm-hmm. I should say, without knowing him or speaking to him directly, this is the way, obviously, it comes off.
Oh, most definitely.
Yeah.
I mean, in a public sphere. Sure. You don't need to know him personally.
Yeah.
People's actions speak louder than words, right? People can spin whatever they want, but De Rosario did. I mean, I don't want to go on a De Rosario kick beer, but De Rosario did make himself unappealing as a person. Now, I'm sure he's a nice guy and gives his kids Christmas gifts and whatever the hell he does. But as a person, as a player, and representing the crest, he made himself look out for one person, and that was him.
Okay.
But De Guzman did not do that.
Yes, let's talk about De Guzman then. Let's get on to De Guzman, and let's sort of just say... I kind of want to start.
It's an era.
Yeah, an era.
What's an era? 10 years?
Well, for Toronto FC,
Fruit Fly era.
Yeah, an era is roughly 1 year.
1 year.
Because we usually attach it to our coaches.
And he was with us for 2 years. What? Over
he came
2 years.
In the end of... No, you came at 2009. The end of 2009. So we have the end of 2009, 10, 11, and part 12. So it's about three.
3 years.
It would have been three this August. So his contract was coming to an end this year.
Time flies when you're having fun, eh?
Yeah. Time flies when you're making $1.9 million.
Drive a yellow Lamborghini, apparently.
But let's sort of discuss that. How, and I, now that I'm, it's, ideas are percolating in my head, and I kind of want to start it off with, I do feel like his signing is sort of representative of that era of Toronto FC that got it drastically wrong. And that was the era that it feels like, even to this day, we're still cleaning up the mess.
Good point.
And that was sort of like the apex, I find, of that period, was that, the summer's winding down in 2009. There's that whole debacle with Dikio because they needed the slot. Like there's so much. Remember, there was so much drama surrounding
it. I remember that. What a
joke! And then they bring
the way they treated him, put a bolt in the back of his head and sent him off to pasture, kind of idea.
Yeah.
Mo Johnston. It was a joke. It was horrific.
For what?
And
that was the
thing. The end of that season. People wanted him back.
Right.
They could have brought him out of retirement, finished the season strong, tip of the hat.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for coming.
Yeah. And that's the thing that I think, him coming in, you hear this name, and everyone sort of knew the name De Guzman, and people sort of knew the kind of player he was to varying
degrees.
There's
a mystique behind that name, his brother now
because,
going to Swansea.
Because at that point, sort of like, from 2000 to 2005, Canadians going across to Europe was pretty rare, but Canadians playing at the highest level in Europe was extremely rare, and the only one I can think of off the top of my head, here's two, is probably... would be Rosinski at Everton, Thomas, and Paul Stalteri in Bremen, and then you had De Guzman. And, for good enough reason, those players, Stalteri and Rosinski were all held up with high regard. And you have De Guzman who's playing at Hanover, and then he goes to Deportivo.
And he came out of that Marseille Youth League too, right? Youth club.
His story is interesting. We did an interview with him when he started, saying how he went to Marseille, and when he finished at Marseille, the coach pretty much told him, you know, you're not going to be a professional football player.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. He's like, just go home.
Wow.
Yeah.
Because of his size?
Just his size and pretty much, and I guess, his assessment of his ability. And he just was like, no. You know, and they, I think just before he left, oh, you know what it was? He, for Canada, he was playing on the U21 team that was going to go to the Olympics. They did their friendlies in Germany because Holger Osiek was the head coach at the time. And when he was in Germany, he got spotted by German teams. And that's how his career... Interesting cycle.
Never give up.
And then from Hanover, he went to Deportivo. And Deportivo had that incredible run, or that little really good streaks between 2006 to 2008. But, I mean, he finished that spell in Spain not playing a lot of games. He was injured. And then he comes to Toronto with this tag that, at that point, you know, it was 2009. There still hadn't been a lot of designated players, and only a couple had really been impact ones, like Juan Pablo and Hell. So the expectations were big and I think one thing, it's sort of like it cuts both ways with Toronto supporters, where some of them are just casual and some of them are diehard. But I do find that there is value in the supporter who just is able to watch the game for what it is, instead of always knowing the backstory, and just be able to assess and say, this guy doesn't look very good. He's not playing very well.
Right.
Why are we paying $2 million for this guy? And I think that was a critique that was pegged on him for a lot of his time here.
Well, they expected that's another thing, is what does the DP name mean? When you come in, I mean, that's difficult for a player. I mean, let's look at it on a personal level. Someone of his class, he's a great player, don't get me wrong, but coming to his hometown, like Dero, you know, coming to his hometown, you have a lot to prove. There's more on your shoulders than anything else. Your family's here, they're being scrutinized, who knows what's happening. But when he showed up, when he came, there was a bit of a laissez-faire attitude with him. It looked like he was, as in the British way of speaking, I've heard on BBC Sport, his paper shoes. You know, they're just here to show up. A lot of these DP guys, they get this view of, they're just going to show up and just retire, semi-retire. But yeah, he was young at the age. What, he was like 27, 28 years
20s.
Old?
I think he would have been still, 28 or 29.
I mean, we were talking about that GSP reference. I mean, you're still viable. You're still fast. You still have your fitness. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was coming off injury.
He was coming off. And remember, he did, through the period of Toronto, he did have those knee surgeries.
Yeah.
And they were serious ones.
So the question is, why bring him in the first place?
Yes. And you know what? That's, you know, without, we could really, like, we could do an just entire 40 minutes.
That, on him. Well,
you
yeah.
know what? I really think when I'm going to look back on De Guzman, I'm going to probably look more on the club more than on him.
Well, I was about to say, MLSE, and then what they were trying to bring in, kind of. Sorry, go ahead.
They've made, you know, they've made so many missteps, and to make your first DP a defensive midfielder, who's, when he's looked his best was when he's been surrounded with really good players, and he's never been a guy that's done it on his own, and that's something that I point at them and saying, you should have known this. Right, and you put him in a situation.
They should have done their research.
You put him in a situation, and I think you also need to look at, you know, a lot of players have come to Toronto FC in those first 5 years, and I'm sure they walked through and said, "What the frick is going on here?" You know, his first preseason with Toronto under Preki, there was what, 14 players.
Right.
You know, and these, you know, and when you have players that are coming from Germany or coming from Spain, where it's like football is everything, and he walks into a club that does their preseason without even playing it, they couldn't play an inter-squad game. I mean, mentally, I think that you have to be like, is this a real club or not?
What did I sign up for?
Yeah, like, is this a real club or not? You know, I'm a professional footballer. I mean, it's just like, you know, you can draw any parallels with, you know, it's like I'm, you know, I work in an office, and they say, I need you to do this, but they don't give you a phone.
Right.
And they don't give you a desk.
I don't give you anything to work with. So right? What you're saying is that the MLSE set them up to fail.
Not on purpose. You know what I mean? I don't think they did it. It's just through their own
ineptitude.
No,
they did it for the name. They
through
did
their own
it,
ineptitude. Right. They think they've done it plenty of times. We've seen lots of players.
Right, but this goes to the bigger picture of how they treat fans. That Anselmi out sign is still in the South End,
yeah,
as it should be, in black. It goes to show you that all they've ever done is cashed in, say, well, you know, the peasants are angry, so let's just give him some some gold in terms of a DP and someone that they can put a name on.
Yeah.
He has to be Canadian. He has to be this. He has to be that. And then that all that did was stem into Dero, because they're linked.
Yeah.
Linked. The way MLSC treated Dero, the way MLSC has treated Dicchio, the way MLSC has treated De Guzman, all D's for whatever reason. But, you know, conspiracy?
Yeah.
But how they've treated the fans is they've just thrown stuff at us and expected us to take. And we've been, because we're starving for success, as any diehards will attest. You know, we go to the games. The games aren't full anymore. We still go. We still watch. We still do this. So that's an attestment to those fans that really want to see success. But unfortunately, there's not a lot of power. And the supporters groups don't do anything, really. They're inner fighting now, apparently, and all this kind of drama and politics. So what do we have to rely on? Well, we have to rely on solidity. We have to rely on someone that cares about the team, and yet there really hasn't been anyone that's really stepped up and given a shit.
This is, and the one thing I wanted to wrap up with De Guzman is that I think a lot of people really deep down wanted them to do well, and I think part of it is because as much as I'm a Toronto FC supporter, I'm also a national team supporter, and his success at the club level, of course, is tied directly to the success of the national team. And but the also thing is that I feel like his time at Toronto FC was almost like just an anchor around the neck of the club moving forward. And it was always something that was, it was the last, again, the last tie to the Mo Johnson era that was sort of riddled with horrible mismanagement of contracts that was always holding the team down. And I would have loved to see him here under a different circumstance, much like Di Rosario. But, you know, it's like I also have to look at the future of the club, and you want the club to move forward. And it's almost like, you know, when Winter came on, they talked about a clean slate and a fresh beginning, but they couldn't really do it.
No, but that's the irony. Clean slate and a fresh beginning would mean that a complete overhaul of everything.
Mm-hmm.
And as we saw, the Winter couldn't work in that system. He couldn't. He was attacked on both sides by business, bureaucracy, and money.
Yeah.
And it didn't work for him.
Right.
He wasn't allowed to be free and breathe.
Yeah. So the last little bit I wanted to say on De Guzman, and as I was watching the season go on, and I was seeing him regain his fitness, and those glimpses of him looking better, and now that he's looked a lot better, you know, whatever happened, if he left now or he left at the end of the year, you know, health, as long as he stays healthy, I still think he's got 2 or 3 years left in the tank, and I think he's going to do well wherever he goes.
He won't be in MLS after this season.
Perhaps not.
No.
If Dallas wants,
And you know what? For the national team speaking, since you brought that up, I hope not for him, because what we've seen with Frings and other star players, maybe not Henri, because he's kind of a class unto himself. He's a very individual player, but that their class drops, it dips.
Right.
The MLS, you can't, like DeVayo, for instance. What a great player. And I think Serie A guys get a lot of shit on for coming to MLS, but these are great players and great athletes. And DeVayo, if you watch, if anyone has Netflix or Xbox or whatever, you can watch on Real Sport, you can watch highlights and stuff, like Game in 6, Toronto, etc. So you watch DeVayo's passing, and how many games has he played? 3 or 4? And it's superb. His vision. DeVayo is coming to MLS and isn't like kind of an individual player, but is able to fit in, but sometimes the finishing for those that he's passing to and those that are around him isn't as good. So eventually that's going to catch up to him, and it'll dip him in form a little bit. And that's what's happening, I think, with De Guzman. I'm not a fan of De Guzman, but I think that those around him, he couldn't, like you were saying earlier, he couldn't play off everybody. So if he goes away to Europe for the national team, this is beneficial, and he can play with people that are much more experienced and a higher class.
Yeah, and you know, it's just a quick side note is that I agree with that, because you know what I think back is, there's been this whole debate, a lot of people saying how much they don't like Terry Dunfield, and there's people who do think he's good, and they say, you know, who's worse than Terry Dunfield? And I can name a lot of midfielders for Toronto that are worse than Terry Dunfield, but the majority of those midfielders were in 2010 under Preki's team, and that was one of the main seasons for Julian De Guzman, where the expectations were high, and he was surrounded by Martin Sarich and Joseph Nan and Jacob Peterson and Nick LaBroca. I mean, those to me are some of the, that's probably the worst midfield I think we've ever had in the 5 years.
Peterson.
Just in terms of like technique.
Peterson is showing himself to be a better player. And
LeBrock
is
doing well in Chivas, but I think it's under whatever system. Yeah. Where it's like if technique is not an issue.
Again, it goes deeper for Toronto FC, right?
Yeah, of course. You know, we can scale us back and skin it back and whatever. But that's sort of, I think, we kind of wrapped up Julie de Guzman's time at Toronto FC. And I think it'll still be a debate. And I know Steve Perry wants to have a few words on it. Probably Wednesday night, we'll probably have a little part because he's, you know, we were talking about him sort of off the thing, and Steve's got interesting comments that are kind of like up and down and left and right, but he calls it as he sees it, and he kind of has a thing where it's like, you know, Toronto FC does have a bad history of sort of ruining Canadian players, and players that come here a lot of times come high and they leave on a
low
and then have to go out and rediscover themselves.
Well, it's like the Leafs, you hear that all the time, players that come in and then they get traded and they don't know how to play anymore because there's so much
scrutiny. We have our share of players that do okay, but I mean, I could probably come up with a pretty quick list off the top of my head of guys who were faltering here severely and not getting playing time and have gone on to establish themselves as starters and do well in the league. You know, LeBrock is one of them. Sam Cronin's one of them. There's a handful.
So it's not the player; it's the organization. And maybe they weren't coached properly. Maybe they weren't given the right time. Mm-hmm. I mean. Cronin left on a bad note, bad mouthing the team, or more like not the team, the organization.
Yeah, I think that's in a subtle way. Sam Cronin is a pretty stand up guy, so I wouldn't.
Oh yeah, no, that, and he should have stayed, and he should have been one of the star players to this day with his team. So,
well, that's that.
But I say goodbye to Guzman. I mean, I'm happy he's gone.
Yeah, you know, and that's the thing where it's just like you almost say too that it's like. I think both parties should move on and get on with it. And De Guzman still has some up in the tank, so it's like, why not? You know,
good luck at
Dallas
because they need him.
Yeah, and I think he'll do well there. Yeah. That system, you know, we've seen 2 years ago what Dallas has under Chelles Hydman when they had Chavez and Ferreira and Breck Shea. They play an attractive, flowing style play that's on the ground.
And that brought them success the last few years.
Yeah. So I mean, we got Colorado on Wednesday. A midweek game at home against Colorado.
Another midweek game.
Yeah, but
nuts.
We're good on them.
Yeah.
I've knocked this out a few times, and if I'm wrong, someone go ahead and correct me. But I don't think we beat Colorado every time at home over the last 5 years. I don't think they've ever even tied us at home. I'm pretty sure we've never lost. So I feel good about that game, and we'll go into like a mini break before we play Houston on the 28th. So
much needed break.
Yeah.
10 days.
Yeah, and maybe we'll see some signings.
We will see signings. That's a definite. Yeah. For sure, 100%. I mean, that's why they're doing all this finagling and moving around. You know, De Guzman's gone, freeing up the salary cap, another DP slot. It's going to happen. Now, the only thing is what's going to happen with Kuvermans, what's going to happen with Johnson being up, how is he going to change this? Is this 4-4-2 going to change? Who knows?
Yeah. All right, well, I think that pretty much wraps it up, Andre.
Done.
Andre, you're on the...
Southeast. Southeast.
And I'm on the Northwest. And thanks a lot for listening, guys. We'll be back on Wednesday night after the game. And we'll catch you
then. Thanks, guys.
Eastside Stand Up is the only Toronto FC specific podcast breaking down the game right after it happens. We want you to get involved. So reach out to us on Twitter at #ESSU or at Red Nation Online or at ClarkRNO. You can also reach out to us on email at haveyoursay@rednationonline.ca or info@rednationonline.ca.